I know when to go out. I know when to stay in. Get things done.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. David Bowie.
Over the last year, I've made a couple of movies, and I've completed an album and a single called Let's Dance. I got to a stage 2 years ago where I found that the experimenting that I was doing was eradicating a lot of the subject matter of my writing. But now I feel for the next few years I'll be concentrating on a lot more basic, earthier kind of material.
Hi, hello, and welcome to Album to Album. And in this edition, we're going to go back to 1983 and Let's Dance. Let's Dance, that big, shiny, loud, brassy album full of disco, funk and soul, the one which saw David Bowie teaming up with Nile Rodgers from Chic and producing an album which was catapulting him into the mainstream. In 1983, Bowie wanted to be a superstar. He actually set out to be a superstar with the same single-minded determination and clarity of focus with which he had tried to become Ziggy Stardust, or the Soul Boy of Young Americans, or the Thin White Duke, or the, well, the whatever it was that he was in Berlin. So, by 1983, he was not especially rich, he wants to rectify that. He had decided to abandon his experimental approach, which had characterized the so-called Berlin Trilogy. Instead, he wants to be a good time guy. To that end, he brought on Nile Rodgers, and together the pair of them cooked up an album which marked Bowie's ascendance into the upper pantheons of pop. And it was there that he stayed for most of 1983, because of course after the album came out, there was a massive 93-date tour around the world. Then, as we all know, things didn't turn out so well. We get to Tonight the following year, and then in 1987, Never Let Me Down. Well, you know the story. Anyway, to discuss this, I invited a friend of mine, the former Rolling Stone Germany journalist and cultural historian Joachim Henschel here in Berlin, to sit down with me and go through what made Let's Dance such an intriguing member of the Bowie canon. He came over and sat down in my kitchen, which is why this recording is going to be a little bit echoey, which I am sorry for, but I think you'll enjoy it. And along the way, Joachim also has the distinction of being a journalist who met David Bowie. Joachim went to New York in 2003 when Bowie was doing a round of press for Reality. And as it turned out, this was probably the last such series of press interviews he gave in his lifetime. The subsequent interview was used in Rolling Stone Germany, but it's never been heard before in English. So I'm very happy to say Joachim has given me some of his tapes, and we're going to be hearing a little bit from his encounter with Bowie from 2003. We talk a lot about the darkness and light that run through the album. So while we could have the big brass harpy trumpets of Modern Love or the groovy hooks of China Girl, then we're putting out fires with gasolines and we have visions of swastikas running through our heads. Let's Dance isn't quite the big bouncy sunshine album that we might think it is. In fact, there's a lot of low-level angst going on here as well. To talk about all of this and much, much more, please set your ears for Let's Dance with me and Joachim Henschel.
You're Joachim Henschel, and it's very lovely to have you here today. And you are a journalist, writer. You've just completed your first book, which is called...
It's called Zu geil für diese Welt, in English, too
beautiful.
Incredible for this world. Yeah. This is actually... Geil also means horny, but in 90s slang in Germany, it was cool or whatever. And it's actually a quote from a German hip-hop band, Die Fantastischen Vier. They had this song, Zu geil für diese Welt. And it's a book about the 1990s. And it's not only about music, it's about the whole lifestyle, the events that shaped culture and that shaped kind of the feeling of kind of living in this decade. I was in my 20s then, and I experienced all this stuff like the Berlin Wall coming down in late 89 and Berlin becoming something like a cool capital and borders falling in Europe. And so you could actually travel everywhere without having to queue at the border and all this kind of this big euphoria and all the hopefulness of the decade and also what came, what became of it in the present. And so this is kind
so
of...
So that's the time span.
Exactly. So David Bowie sadly doesn't really play a role in that, because even though that was exactly the time that we just talked about, when he did the drum and bass experiments, and we did Outside, something like a narrative experiment. But I think he doesn't come up at all. But nevertheless, he plays a big, big, big role in my personal life. And also in kind of, in a way, what, it sounds a bit pathetic, I know, but kind of seeing Ashes to Ashes on the little television set at my, in my parents' bedroom when I was 10, really put a spark in me. And it's a bit like, I still have this feeling that that was kind of what brought me the whole fascination for pop music. And in a way, this is still what's driving me, even, I know this sounds pathetic, but
no, not at all. This sounds actually really interesting. Was that your first memory of encountering Bowie?
That was actually my first getting in touch with him, because that was right when disco was big, and you know, I was 10 years old. I only got in touch with music via television and the radio, and of course David Bowie was not on television and the radio in Germany at the time. And there was one, in the late 70s, because, you know, the radio stations I listened to as a 9 or 10 year old, there was of course no Bowie going on.
Right.
And then there was one music show in Bavarian television that dedicated itself to music video. That was kind of the principle of the show, and it was they broadcasted it in the afternoon. And of course, at the time in 1979, 1980, there were actually not many music videos.
I was just going to say there wasn't really much going on in terms of videos.
Exactly, because medium. Artists like ABBA or whoever, they were still kind of traveling around and performing in TV studios, or maybe sending out broadcasts of TV performances to other shows they didn't want to go to. And as a matter of fact, this afternoon show in Bavarian television consisted mostly of really, really strange acts. You know, there was Devo videos, there was The Residents. I even saw something like a thing, 5 clips from The Residents commercial album that they showed. And I was really shocked by all that. It introduced so many different colors and so many different things that I couldn't catch from listening to the radio. And then I actually really remember the shockwave that it sent through me when Ashes to Ashes by Bowie was shown there, because this was, you know, all the things that I was used to from watching disco television and also watching like bands like the Dire Straits perform, always kind of this close proximity between music and the performance of music. You could always, if someone played the guitar, you can see him or her play the guitar and you can listen to it. It was all very, very straight and very kind of non-enigmatic. And I saw that, of course, that everybody knows the Ashes to Ashes video, but this whole idea of what other levels of colors, what other levels of fantasy, what other levels of kind of, how could you say,
otherworldliness, the weirdness of it. And I imagine if you know, you're in growing up in the countryside in Germany, you're a 10-year-old kid, obviously your cultural horizons are still expanding. But then to see that video, which was by any measure an extraordinary video, I mean, very little had been seen like that on British television. I think it was David Mallet
who directed
this, and he had done the Lodger videos, which we talked about the other week with Nick Pegg. But this video, people still talk about it now. I mean, the video basically invented new romanticism in London. I mean, people like the Blitz Club and everything came up in its wake. That video was inestimable. I find it really interesting to hear your perspective as a 10-year-old seeing this on
in
a small
TV. In the German countryside. And just because kind of what level pop music, what other levels of darkness, what other levels of disturbance pop music could lead to, there was nothing like this was ever present in kind of disco music cheering you up, or on the other hand, bands like the Dire Straits or Police playing on television and just being serious musicians, and all these levels. And I really remember, I'm not exaggerating this, I really remember this like a flash coming from this TV set and just getting into me and just planting all these ideas in me. And I was scared. I was scared to look at this. It was a shock to me, but somehow it changed kind of my perception of what music and what pop or what kind of this strange thing that looked like entertainment was seemed to be something totally different.
Yeah.
What it could do. And this was also kind of, in a way, it also preformed the image of Bowie that I had in the upcoming years, of this kind of otherworldly creature, this alien. There was also the movie Christiane F, in which Bowie played a big part. Of course, I wasn't allowed to watch it because I was too little, but there was photos in magazines with Bowie posing with the protagonist of the movie and all that. And all this kind of, this very dark and very alienated kind of sphere that Bowie was connected to. That was very, very present at the
kind
time.
Kind of like a shorthand for an underworld.
Exactly, exactly.
He was. I think a lot of us, when we were growing up, Bowie, our initial encounters with David Bowie were this... into a sunny childhood existence came this being, which was kind of like a metaphor for all sorts of unknown things, which were incredibly exciting and intriguing. Yeah.
Anyway, and even stuff like, although now I'm kind of broadening the scale, even stuff like Duran Duran, Yazoo, Heaven 17, Culture Club, all this, and in a way, even a band like ABC, although it doesn't have the, you could actually draw a line from Young Americans and Fame to a band like ABC wearing the gold lamé suits and all that. And the strange thing that happened at the time, that was that these creatures, who somehow they carried an air of Bowie-ness with them. And even I, as a 10, 11-year-old, I could spot that. I could feel that they actually were, that they came out of this gap that was ripped in my world by the Ashes to Ashes video. And they walked out of it, but they became successful. They had hits, and they were very present. Their faces were on magazines everywhere. But strangely, Bowie himself, he was not present at all in these years. And we know why, because at that time, he was playing, he was doing theater, he was doing movies, and he didn't act, well, he appeared on this Queen single, Under Pressure, but somehow he was strangely absent. And so, in a way, even though you can't really compare this to the Ashes to Ashes incident, when in 1983, I first saw the Let's Dance video on the German chart TV show Formel 1, it was a similar, strange incident for me, seeing him like that, when kind of his successors had made it seemingly bigger than himself. And that was kind of his return to the presence of pop culture. And I don't know, what do you remember seeing Let's Dance for the very first time? It's not that memorable, but nevertheless.
It's actually China Girl I remember for the first time. When I was 9 years old then in 83, and my cousin who lived nearby, she used to go and buy 7-inch singles every weekend with her pocket money. And then we'd go and listen to them. And I remember very clearly sitting on the living room floor at her house, and she got out China Girl with this... do you remember the sleeve of that? It's this girl with an incredibly long finger.
Yeah. I think it was his girlfriend at the time, wasn't it?
I think... Ji Ling, yeah. She was a Chinese actress, and she'd had a bit of a fling with him. I don't know if girlfriend is entirely accurate.
In one biography.
But I remember the video for it. And looking back at that video now, it's you wouldn't be able to, let's just say you wouldn't be able to get away with that now. I mean, there's some really toe-curling moments in that video where he's doing his, and when my little China girl gets excited.
Fleeing the rice bowl into the air.
The rice bowl, the funny Chinese face that he does, it's a bit like, ah. But there was that very famous scene where he replays From Here to Eternity, sort of, having love on the beat. But anyway,
making sweet love.
But let's just focus on a very interesting point you brought up now. Where was Bowie during this time? He wasn't there. The Blitz Kids had grown up, New Romanticism had grown up, but Bowie himself was giving interviews, if at all, and he was saying, oh God, I'm bored of being cool, I'm bored of synthesizers, I'm bored. I mean, he kind of realized now with the completion of the Berlin trilogy, with the completion of Scary Monsters, he got known for making this sort of esoteric, experimental, sort of quite challenging music. And I believe in an interview around the time of Let's Dance, he was saying, look, I felt that form was overshadowing content. I felt that my experimentalism was, coming at the expense of feeling and emotion and so on. I want to write songs again. Which is very interesting. And there's also, I think, a far more prosaic reality as well, which is under the terms of his severance deal with his previous manager.
Yeah, I read that one time. That kind of, I think there was something like a time in May 82 or something. Something like a deadline.
Yeah.
And everything that he produced before that Tony DeFries still had some hands or some more percentages in it and something.
I think so. I need to check that, but I think that's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
And when it came down to it, he needed to make money. I mean, RCA hadn't really... He'd left RCA on fairly bad terms. Mm-hmm. He felt they hadn't understood him or promoted his last few albums. Mm-hmm. He claimed that they had not really been behind Lodger and Heroes and Scary Monsters.
And that they hadn't paid him the advance that he would have deserved for that.
Right.
And because apparently, I read somewhere that when he produced the Under Pressure song with Queen, mm-hmm. that he talked to, or even before that, he talked to Freddie Mercury, and Freddie Mercury told him the terms that people, that artists at EMI were working mm-hmm. at, and Bowie, apparently he was furious. Yeah. He wrote a really, really annoyed letter to RCA, kind of quoting some of the figures that Mercury mm-hmm. had told. I don't know whether this is a true story, but...
Oh, it certainly fits. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So... When that contract came up, then he was clearly looking for money. He hadn't made much money. I mean, the managerial chaos of the 1970s had left him pretty, you know, down on his luck. And making commercial, I don't think you could call Lodger and Heroes failures, but they certainly weren't massive sellers. There's a famous quote where Bowie was saying RCA at one point got so desperate they offered to get him an apartment in Philadelphia just so he could go back and do Young Americans Part 2. And he said, well, that's not what I mean. I need you to support me. Anyway, so long story short, here we get to EMI, who are delighted with their new signing. Big, big advance. And now he wants to make hits.
Yeah.
He wants mainstream success. He wants to stop being the strange experimental alien working with the egghead Brian Eno. He wants to be a hit-making mainstream money making machine. In a sense, this is
apparently he showed when he casted Nile Rodgers,
yes.
who we're going to get to him later as his co-producer. Apparently, he showed him a little photo of Little Richard in a red leather jacket getting out of a Cadillac, yeah. and he said, "I want my next record to sound like this picture."
Exactly, which is, I think, it sums it all up really, because that's what exactly happened.
But this is not what the record actually says.
Well, I think I can see what Nile Rodgers did with that. I can see what Bowie was, where he was coming from. I mean, if you had just done three albums, you know, which everyone's calling the Berlin Trilogy, where you really, I mean, Low, when that came out, that was revolutionary. And then Scary Monsters and Super Creeps was a very, you know, angular, experimental, strange mm-hmm. album. And you can see why this person who was never content just to stay in one place was like, all right, enough of all that. I want to make hits. I want to make money. I'm completely shameless. You know, I want to have fun. I want some bounce, excitement. In a way, he was, again, channeling the spirit of the times. You know, this was the early 80s, and certainly in the UK, you know, this was a period, well, maybe just ahead of the post-Falklands period of... A boom, you know, under Thatcher, there was this big boom. Everybody was ostentatious, loud, bold, you know, lots of bright colours everywhere.
And also kind of, it was the beginning age of MTV.
Yes.
And it was something that I think getting on high rotation with videos like Ashes to Ashes or Fashion or I don't know whether there was a video for Up the Hill Backwards or whatever. I think it might have been a little difficult for him to kind of really to be a good competitor compared to Hungry Like a Wolf by Duran Duran or Wham, Club Tropicana, and all this other stuff that was going on at the time. And so I think some people say that this was also the time when Bowie realized that he would have to market himself as kind of a brand, not only as a musician, not only as a creative, not only as an artist, but also something like a brand, that's something like recognizable. And this was also one of the reasons why he chose to work with Rodgers and do this kind of record.
Nile Rodgers comes on board. Tony Visconti is out of the picture, much mm-hmm. to his
annoyance. And he's totally pissed because he had cancelled stuff.
Yeah.
And then calling up Coco Schwab and tell, so when are we going to start? And she said, oh, well, they already started. Sorry.
Visconti has always come across as being a very tender-hearted, kind, very loyal sidekick. And I think just to be... But Bowie does that. Bowie would just go ahead and drop this musician, drop that collaborator, start with somebody. He's always done that. His career is littered with, you know, annoyed, angry people.
I think it was similar with Carlos Alomar.
Yes.
For that one. Because I read somewhere that the fees that EMI announced Carlos Alomar were so poor that he actually said, oh, no, I'm not going to do this. But strangely, when a few months later, when they went on tour, he was in again. But
Alomar was pretty much Bowie's de facto band leader,
mm-hmm.
I think during the last few years, definitely. And when Bowie's management approached him and said, okay, well, you're going to come on board, you're not going to be the band leader. Nile Rodgers is going to be directing, musical director. Mm-hmm. You're just going to be the guitarist. And yes, like you said, the money was terrible. And Alan was like, well, you know, screw you, and walked away. But Bowie needed him. I think, like Dennis Davis, the drummer that he used to work with, Alomar was one of these wonderful musicians that could just deal with anything. And I think he was getting annoyed with the more out there experimental, for the sake of being experimental, antics that were going on mm-hmm. Lodger. I mean, mm-hmm. I know he was annoyed. I read somewhere that he was annoyed with, you know, Eno directing them to all play each other's instruments and stuff like that. But, you know, you've got to feel bad for the guy. But yes, when it came to Serious Moonlight, there he was, out mm-hmm. on tour and doing a fantastic job. But to come back mm-hmm. to the background of the album,
yeah.
So Bowie had happened upon Nile Rodgers. He showed Nile Rodgers, you know, this photograph. He knew that Nile Rodgers made hits, and he was like, right, let's make a hit album.
Mm-hmm.
I love this story of one of the first things Bowie played to Nile was a very folky acoustic tune. He had a 12-string, but he'd only had 6 strings
yeah. on
it. And it was called Let's Dance. And I was like, how can you write a song called Let's Dance, which is not going to make a single person want to get up and dance? And he was like, well, Bowie was convinced this was going to be a huge hit. But mm-hmm. then,
mm-hmm.
obviously, he takes it, and like you said,
yeah.
you know, works it around, puts together a little band, they come up with a demo, and we get the bare bones of yeah. what becomes
yeah.
Bowie's probably biggest single.
And the fun thing is that, you know how this term Serious Moonlight came about?
He was saying, something like,
no,
it's disco slang. You know,
yeah, serious, exactly. Because apparently Nile Rodgers was always saying, oh, this is serious.
Right.
When something sounded good, he said, oh, this is serious stuff. Or however.
Yeah.
And then, so apparently, in a way, he's already mocking his producer in the song. Isn't that? Because I was thinking about that. I don't know whether you agree, because that was actually, wasn't that the first time in his career that he actually made a creative decision kind of in order to adopt a sound that was already created and designed and successful that alluded to someone else? Because at the time, you kind of choosing Nile Rodgers as a co-producer would also mean that this record would sound a bit like Chic mm. sounded. And if you listen to this demo that emerged, the Let's Dance demo that emerged, that mm. was even done, I think, in December 82, even before
yeah.
he had signed the EMI deal. So in a very, very early stage when he still wasn't really sure how all this was going on. He must have been very conscious of the fact that this would be an album that people wouldn't say it sounds like Bowie. They would say it's a typical Nile Rodgers sounding thing.
Interesting you say that. I listened again to the album the other day. To me, Let's Dance, the title track, is a Chic song. I mean, it's like a mixture of Good Times and Lafrique. Like, if you listen
Absolutely.
To the bass line, dun, 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 dun,
mm-hmm.
dun, it is slowed down.
There, yeah.
There's definitely a lightness. There, mm-hmm. there's a real sparkle about some of these songs.
And this is actually just going back to kind of this impression that this song, when then it was kind of finished and it was made into a video in Australia, I just wanted to, this is a good
video,
point, mentioning
yeah.
that seeing that on German television in 1983 was the first time that you saw Bowie with other usual normal people, in a kind of in a social situation. In this kind of bar, in this hotel bar, with the Aborigines, with people actually maybe not even knowing who that guy was because they had never heard of Bowie before, and seeing him smile, because I'd never seen, and seeing him with his 80s hairstyle, with this kind of exploded pineapple thing or whatever, because I remember that this was the introduction of the 80s Bowie hairstyle that I think he kept through all these years, and that was, in a way, it was the counterpart to the Ashes to Ashes experience,
yeah.
kind of Bowie kind of returning to Earth and kind of being physical for the first time in many years. And I don't know whether you remember that, but he actually plays his guitar with white gloves.
Really?
Yeah, something that you could never do. You could never ever, you know that you're a guitarist as well, you could never ever play a Fender Stratocaster with white gloves on both hands, but this is what he does. And this is how he kind of, he mimes the Stevie Ray Vaughan solo in the end of the video, being kind of the sun going down, Bowie standing in a field with his guitar and miming to the solo with white gloves. And this is kind of a combination on the one hand and of this kind of the sophisticatedness of his appearance, kind of the suited well-dressed Bowie, not the dark Christiane F., heroin afflicted guy. And on the other hand, kind of his presence as a normal human being that would get on a dance floor and dance, or tell other people to go on the dance floor and dance while he's standing on the side and narrating the whole thing, just not as a protagonist, but as kind of a narrator.
Yes. Although a normal human being is unlikely to stand in the middle of a field in the outback with white gloves on playing a Fender Stratocaster. But in mentioning the video, you brought up something which is fundamental to this album, which is the underlying darkness, the tension, because there is a darkness to this song, there's a darkness to quite a few of the songs. The sunny side up atmosphere really does hold these little shadows. I mean, the video is quite a strange video. Now, you wouldn't expect a song which was an outright celebration of hedonism and dancing to take place in the Australian outback and feature a peculiar narrative of two native Australians seen, you know, scrubbing streets and pulling heavy machinery and so on. I mean, clearly a point was being made here.
I know there's lots of interpretations about what the video is about, but did you ever really get the story?
No, because, I mean, beyond some sort of commentary about colonialization, about oppression,
capitalism.
I mean, like the red shoes, you know, is a real American cliche, isn't it? You know, put on your red shoes,
Wizard of
dance
Oz.
The blues. It's a strange video, and it's, again, I think it's also underlining the fact that while Bowie might have appeared to have gone utterly mental, and you know, perched a fizzy blancmange on the top of his head and be wearing these 50s zoot suits, he is also saying, look, you know, I still care very deeply about these things. And, you know, this bouncy pop song, this funk classic, has a very deep meaning to it. But why the plight of the Aboriginals in Australia? I don't know.
No, and I think at the time, that was not when I, you know, I speak from the position of a typical teenage pop user at the time. I was 12 or 13 years at the time when I saw that. I knew that Bowie existed. I had this very strange and very, very important experience with him, seeing him on television doing Ashes to Ashes. But at the time, of course, I was growing up. I was looking and longing for dance music. And it was something like a summer record. Yeah, that summer of 1983, Germany, it was the biggest hit of his whole career. Mm. He went to number 2 in the German single charts. I think the biggest hit he had before that was actually Sound and Vision. It went to number 6 in 1977 in Germany. A bit of a surprise.
Was Heroes not a big hit?
No, Heroes was not in the charts.
That's strange, because Nick Pegg was...
No, I think it was, but it wasn't that high. No. Sound and Vision was actually quite big. Maybe it wasn't a TV show or something.
Right.
But then Let's Dance went to number 2. It was held off by Too Shy by Kajagoogoo. Really. But you can see the competition, kind of the field that Bowie was positioning himself in. And I just remember, and this is actually, I even brought along...
This is the copy of
the Let's Dance album, because at the time I didn't have that much pocket money, so I couldn't buy all these singles. I remember buying that in Ulm, in a record shop in Ulm. I don't know which one it was, for 1490 Deutschmarks. You could also... Sometimes they were something like 16 or 17. That was rather cheap because it was a chart record. Chart records were a bit cheaper. I just remember this being on the radio and television in Germany all the time, the whole summer. And then, of course, China Girl came and Modern Love came. And it was just kind of the... compared to these 3 years before, where Bowie somehow was present in pop culture, but never with his own face, only as an influence on people that made it bigger. In my impression, made it bigger than him. Suddenly, he was there, but he was different. He talked about the video and about the strange combination of being outright and being physical and even sweating. I think you can even see sweat on his face in the video, something that he would never have done as an alien. He wouldn't have sweat pores at all. And on the other hand, also still being, you alluded to this political and to this to this anti-racism thing, and also just his voice, the way he sang in China was still very mysterious. But on the other hand, Bowie really put himself on the map in a very, very strong way, and he suddenly was there among all these other characters, and he fit in well. You know, Bowie in this phase next to Simon Le Bon from Duran Duran, they could have been brothers. Or they could have been, maybe not brothers, but...
There was no love lost between them.
I mean, exactly.
Dennis O'Regan, who was the tour photographer on Serious Moonlight, left Bowie's tour to go and photograph Duran Duran. Yeah. And Bowie's like, are you mad? What are you doing? You're leaving my tour for Duran Duran. But Duran Duran were, as you said earlier, one of the Blitz kids, one of the new romantics that kind of came in Bowie's aftermath.
Yeah, and shortly after that, Nile Rodgers went on to produce The Reflex by Duran Duran, which sounds like Let's Dance in a way.
And so I don't know. I don't think it does.
I think does. Let's say it sounds like a track that could have been on the album.
I wish it had been. I mean, Bowie doing the remix would have been quite good, especially with that kind of those Caribbean steel drums in the little bridges there. Yeah. Let's Dance. Another thing about Let's Dance is, so Nile Rodgers went back, retooled it. I love the way he brings in that intro. I think inspired, let's say, by the Beatles' Twist and Shout.
Could be.
Oh, that was terrible. That's really bad. Can you do it?
Very reflexy, however.
I don't know. Maybe I'm having some sort of mental disconnect. I can't see the reflex in that. But anyway,
try it. Whatever.
The reflex. Flex. That's all I can remember.
But this music, the musical track, it's exciting. It's just as you... It's exactly the chic beat and the chic bass guitar. Oh. Hubba, you can listen to it.
I will listen. I'm sure you're right, but I will listen to
I'm
it.
Sure.
I'm sure you're right. So the chic beat, the chic guitar, mm-hmm. and it's not... Sheik playing on this, obviously. It's Nile Rodgers is playing this, but Bernard Edwards is not here. The Sheik drummer.
He's playing on Without You.
He's on Without You.
That's the only track he's on.
Yeah. And there's a lovely story where Bowie and the whole gang were quite nervous about Bernard Edwards coming in because he was having some drug problems at the time. And Nile Rodgers said, he's going to come in, he's going to be really obnoxious and unpleasant. And Bowie's like, no, he won't. He'll be fine. And of course, Bernard Edwards comes in and he's like, okay, what do you want? And Nile Rodgers plays Without You, and he's there 20 minutes, just puts out an amazing bass line, and then literally just says, is that what you want? Are we done? And then he just goes. But and we'll come on to Without You in a bit, but someone talk about that. But
this is something that you really have, even though we are going to say a lot of bad and evil things about Bowie in the 80s, maybe later on, I think what you could never ever accuse him of is kind of not doing justice to his own style of singing. It's always very, very distinctive Bowie, kind of how he performs the song. And even, I think, there's not even a really, really bad lyric on that record.
On the Let's Dance
album? Yeah.
Oh, is there? It's interesting you say that. He was at an interview at the time. They said, did you play anything? Because I didn't play not a single damn thing. This was a singer's album. And it very much was. He was the singer. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he's really... I mean, I can't fault his performances on Scary Monsters, but here he's really bringing it, isn't he, as a singer?
Absolutely.
I think he'd been maybe taking lessons or doing something, but here the voice is so expressive and so compelling and such a part of the texture of the album. Like if you listen to something like Ricochet, for example, he's really down that low register.
Yeah. Or I think China Girl even has... China Girl is a very, very strong vocal performance. If you really listen to it from beginning to end, kind of the different styles of it, the different shades he brings to his singing, especially when this middle part where he says, my little China girl, you shouldn't mess with me. It's really, really scary.
It's very menacing, isn't it?
Yeah, menacing.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to be his little China girl in that particular situation.
And on the other hand, listen to something like Modern Love, where he really belts out hopeful,
yearning.
Soulful
thing. It is a soulful song. It's a belter, isn't it? Yeah. And I know what you mean. It's got that great, creaky intro. I mean, so this is the song that obviously kicks off the album.
Yeah.
And it comes in and it punches you in the face. And that funny little, he does his little Tommy Steele. I know when to go out.
Yeah.
I know when to stay in, get things done. But then you get this like big brassy number. It kind of sets the tone of the whole album, doesn't it? Like lots of horns, the big sing-along, da-da-da chorus. It's like a showbiz classic, but again, Modern Love terrifies me. Modern Love, won't somebody help me? It's a song of doubt.
Absolutely. Although I think musically it doesn't really, it's not really representative of the album. It sounds more like a bit of like a Motown single in a way to me.
Yeah, I think it sounds like a Motown single. Yeah. But I think it comes again from the same wellspring of inspiration.
That's true. But especially kind of the whole power and the drive that's in there. I don't know, have you seen this? There's actually, I know two movies in which the song Modern Love has been used as a centerpiece. Belgian director Leos Carax, he made a movie called Mauvais Sang in Evil Blood in the 1980s with Juliette Binoche. It's a very, very strange scene. It's something like two lovers, Juliette Binoche and Denis Lavant, at home at night, and they're talking, and he puts on the radio, and then he steps outside into the street, and then suddenly Modern Love comes on, and he starts running, and it's a very, very strange scene. It's a big, big tracking shot, and it's kind of like half of the song. Wow. He's just running along the street, and this is such an impressive scene, and the scene has made such an impact on the director Noah Baumbach. And do you know Frances Ha with Greta Gerwig?
Yes.
It's a great movie, but they actually copied the scene from Mauvais Sang. There's also a Modern Love running scene with Greta Gerwig in Frances Ha. I think it's something like an impulse for letting out your feelings, an impulse for getting into motion. Because in these images, people who are in strange situations, they start running and they free themselves. And this is kind of the soundtrack. This is kind of it's a bit like as if what the heartbeat sounds like. Bam, bam, bam. Just this very, very impressive driving drum intro. It's a bit like you can listen to their hearts and then somehow these emotions and this longing and all this, what we just talked about, comes out and it expresses themselves in them running. Of course, well, it's art. You can't really explain it. Although it's not been a commercially successful, it's not been considered one of the big Bowie singles, has it? When, at least in Germany, well, I didn't look up all the chart results, but just because I was talking from the German perspective, Let's Dance went to number 2, China Girl went to number 6, and Modern Love only went to number 27.
27?
Yeah.
What's the matter with Germans. You guys? What else was in the charts that day? Thompson Twins?
Kraftwerk.
Oh, God.
Heino.
Yeah, Pop Au Vuh at number 1. Heino at number 2. And Kraftwerk at number 3.
But would you say that
I think it's a great song.
People choose 20, 20 favorite, 20 biggest Bowie songs, that Modern Love would be among them?
Yeah. For me, personally, it beats China Girl and Let's Dance. Which, I mean, let's face it, this album is basically Modern Love, Let's Dance and China Girl, and maybe Without You as well. I mean, that's all we can remember. I mean, Criminal World by Metro is a fairly good cover, but it's very slight.
Yeah,
and I think
Cat People.
I think that's a terrible.
An inferior version of Cat People.
Yeah. I mean,
although I read somewhere that he actually wanted to put the Giorgio Moroder original on it, but they wouldn't give him the rights, so he had to re-record it.
Imagine if Giorgio Moroder had done this album. And I'm wondering why he didn't. He seems to sort of tick so many of Bowie's boxes at the time.
Yeah, but I'm not sure whether this was kind of the direction Bowie wanted to go in at the time. But maybe I can just kind of stop the show a little at this point, because I was lucky enough to meet and interview David Bowie.
You did, yes.
Yeah, in 2003. When the album Reality came out, and I was working for Rolling Stone, German version of Rolling Stone magazine at the time. And at the time, nobody knew that this was going to be David Bowie's last round of press interviews ever, because, you know, after Reality, he went on the hiatus, and then he didn't give any press interviews anymore.
So this really would have been amongst his very, very final interviews.
In a way, yes. And I got the chance to meet him in New York and do an hour of interview about his whole career. And I had no idea that on this day, today, we were going to talk about Let's Dance, and this was come in handy. Mm. But in this interview, we talked about Let's Dance, because I remember us going through this, through his career, and I said, I don't know the exact question, but something like that, to me, Let's Dance always, and this is just how, as we discussed it now earlier, that it seems like a very conscious career move to do something new, to stop, rethink, and start again with a new concept. And
we can listen to what he said
after that, and maybe discuss some of his points later on.
You never go into an album thinking it's going to be anything more than just your next album.
Mm.
And
It sounded a bit like that. Just
no way did we, but Niall and I believe that. I mean, we had no idea that Let's Dance was going to do so well on a commercial level. For me, it was just a natural continuation. I mean, it really had some quite, I thought, very interesting pieces on it that were a development from where I'd gone before. Like Let's Dance, I like very much. I like Let's Dance as an album. I think it's very...
I like it too.
I think aesthetically it works at a lot of levels. Things like Ricochet, for me, are actually really good pieces of work. I think it's a really strange piece of work. You know, it's very odd. And the whole idea of putting into that dance kind of situation such an aesthetically pure blues guitarist as Stevie Ray Vaughan, there was nothing like that, you must remember. It wasn't aping anything. It sounded like what it was, which is a really interesting new hybridization, you know. And we were very excited about it. We knew that that was such a terrific smashing of things that, you know, weren't normally a part of each other. Especially coming out of that very cold, instigated by the whole the Germanic electronic kind of process, we kind of moved the other way and said, okay, yeah, dance is great, but what happens if... You know, you kind of make it more, you humanize it again, away from what it has been with the new romantics and all that stuff. And so, it's like, God, I'm fed up with all this shit, aren't you? Now, let's cut, you know, let's try and put it back in another place again.
So let's try and put it back in another place again. He wants to take it back. I mean, it's his fault. It's his fault. He invented the bloody new romantics.
Yeah, but and the main question is, did he succeed by trying that? Did the solos or the contributions by Texas guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan really introduce a human element to the otherwise cold or cool, sophisticated dance music background that Nile Rodgers
sent? I mean, it's about as far away as you can get from, say, the Eno trilogy or something, isn't it? This, like, old school... blues guy from Texas. I mean, how? I mean, he wore a Stetson hat and everything. But I quite like what he brings. He really brought something very soulful, I think, to the album. Those little licks that he does. You know, he's like doing these gorgeous little solos and licks throughout.
Yeah, but I think it doesn't work in all songs, because I think in Let's Dance it works really, really well because he's really on his soulfulest. But on some of the other tracks, especially in I think Cat People is a very, very evil example of him just noodling away and doing exactly the kind of... I know maybe I'm not doing Stevie Ray Vaughan justice by saying that, but it's like kind of the guy improvising on stage, the jam band playing. And to me, it sounds... Sometimes it's a real mess to my ears.
But then to my ears, Cat People is a real mess.
Yeah.
Stevie Ray Vaughan doesn't make it any worse or better, in my opinion. I mean, I think he's used very well, like you say, on Let's Dance. But he... Yeah, Let's Dance, and also on China Girl. Although I think China Girl... But again, what a strange choice of collaborator. Because you would have thought this would be somebody who Bowie would have instinctively... picked. You know, he's going in this certain direction, as you just heard now in that quote. He wants to bring some soul, some humanity. You know, he's basically saying, you know, all this dance stuff is, all this electro stuff is great, but, you know, I want to bring up a bit more soul to
it. Yes, but to me, kind of the rest of the musicians on Let's Dance are soulful enough already.
And they're a great band, aren't
they? Yeah, absolutely.
Really good band. Who is it? So it's Carlos Alomar. Not Colour.
I think we can read from...
Let's have a look at the
record cover. Isn't it Omar Hakim on drums?
Yeah.
This is a... the bass player is Carmine Roya.
Yes.
Whoever that is. Tony Thompson is also on it. Nile Rodgers, of course. Rob Sabino is the keyboard player. And, of course, all the kind of the trumpet and the kind of the brass people. Even without all the guitar solos, this would be kind of a total... a very... humanize in a very, very kind of life-sounding record. It doesn't really sound like something made up in a cold electronic studio.
No, definitely not. I mean,
it's very alive.
It's very alive. It's I think at the time he said it's a new kind of hybrid using blues rock guitar against a dance format, and there was nothing else really that sounded like that at the time, which is a very good point. Prior to making Let's Dance, when he was shooting Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, which I think came out in 82, he was stuck in the South Pacific somewhere on this shoot. And so he said he wanted to take along music to listen to, which wouldn't grow boring. So he didn't want to take the latest experimental sounds. He wanted to take music that he could just take this cassette player and just sit there for however long this shoot took. Mm-hmm. And so he took a lot of 50s R&B, a lot of early rock and roll, mm-hmm. a lot of soul, doo-wop, and so on. And that really inspired this batch of songs. But then you mentioned Stevie Ray Vaughan. Bringing that in, I think, was a progression of that. And let's not forget as well, this is nothing new in Bowie's canon. I mean, the idea that he just came out of nowhere with a kind of like soulful dance, funk, you know, orientated album. If you go back to the 1960s when he started out, he was playing saxophone. He was, he loved R&B. He loved soul. He loved all these different styles. And it's kind of like run through his career. I mean, obviously there's the big Young Americans project of 74, 75, which so excited him at the time that it, well, while he was touring Diamond Dogs, halfway through he said, right, forget that, I'm going to go soul. And he went to Philadelphia with him. So this dance element, this funk element, this disco, whatever you want to call it, has always been there.
Yeah. Just listen to Fame, which is, of course, the prime example.
Golden Years, Fame, Young Americans. I mean, tracks on the Young Americans album, like Can You Hear Me, but more Win, Right, are fantastic. I mean, he rather disparagingly put them down as blue-eyed soul later. But I think coming into Let's Dance, it was like, okay, well, I want to, you know, what do I pick? Okay, I pick that, and I take a bit of this, bring it together, and this is what we get. So we've discussed the title track, Let's Dance. We've discussed Modern Love with its great big funky intro and blaring horns. We've talked a little bit about China Girl, which was an Iggy Pop song, wasn't it? I don't know if... Was it a Bowie pop song, or was it just Iggy who wrote that song?
It was a Bowie pop
song. It was a Bowie and Iggy pop song.
Yeah.
Written right here in Berlin. And but of course, Bowie's version has that incredibly cheesy little Oriental-style riff to it. And there's a lovely story about Nile Rodgers coming up with this and going, I don't think I'm going to get sacked tomorrow when I play this to him. Or he's going to love it. But he's like, that's fantastic, let's use it. But
the funny thing is, when before I came here and I watched China Girl on YouTube, kind of the next video that was proposed to me by the algorithm was 10 racist stereotypes in Disney movies. And it was about typical Asian stereotypes in Disney animals, kind of with the eyes and the big chunky teeth and all that. And so somehow there was kind of a relation between the China Girl video and Disney racism.
Like I said to you before, I find the China Girl video bizarre in his, especially when he pulls a sort of like bad imitation of a Chinese face. It's just kind of, what are you doing?
And in 1983, I think there was what we call political correctness didn't exist yet. And I'm not sure whether he was that conscious or whether the subtlety of the discourse wasn't that. I think at the time there were still German left-wing rock bands who used the word Negro, Neger. Mm. There was one band called BAP, who clearly belonged to the pacifist, anti-American left-wing movement in Germany. And they had one song about a clochard, and they used the word Neger, and of course they were talking in his voice, but nevertheless you wouldn't do that to
a clochard.
What you call it, a homeless person.
Oh, okay.
Who talked about his experiences in Africa. From today's perspective, you would look at it at this differently.
It's definitely, I mean, coming back to China Girl, it's something that even crops up in the lyrics. Visions of swastikas in my head, plans for everyone. If that's not a slightly scary, I mean, there are, you know, it's quite a scary song, like you mentioned earlier, when he's My Little China Girl, You Shouldn't Mess With Me.
Yeah, the way he sings this.
Yeah, you know, it's that there's a menacing, dark undertow to this slightly goofy, la, 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 little China girl.
And this is also kind of the moment when, because this is also a very trademark Nile Rodgers track. This beat and the bass guitar.
Yeah.
And there's some passages in the song that are very, very raw I think you can only hear the bass and the drums, and then Stevie Ray Vaughan comes in. I think this is where kind of the whole viciousness that somehow is implied in the gentle, dancey cheek style somehow comes out in this moment.
Towards the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you know which passage I'm talking about.
I do. I mean, I really like these old rock guitars. To me, that's a very Dave Gilmour style.
A bit, yes.
Appearance by Stevie Ray Vaughan. You know, he comes in at the end like
comfortably numb.
Comfortably style. Numb, or on McCartney's No More Lonely Nights when Gilmour comes at the end with a, you know, like big magisterial solo. Stevie Ray Vaughan on China Girl, if you like that kind of thing, really brings it. He really delivers the goods there. I love that. Personally, I love that solo at the end of China Girl. It's just, it fits beautifully. Like you said, this, you know, like the menace, the kind of like the latent dread in the song. It all comes out in that beautiful.
Although, nevertheless, to me, this is a rock song. This is not a dance song.
It's a rock song.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. So, no, just because I'm a little... We just listened to this quote, Bowie describing his achievement on Let's Dance, combining dance music and rock music. I think in this case, maybe he would like it to be like that. But in the end, this is a rock record. But I personally still have a secret favorite, and that's Ricochet. Really? I know that many people say that this is kind of one of the weakest songs that Bowie has ever written, that there's no melody in it, and it's just a couple of, I don't know, a couple of words and a couple of chants and shouts. But I really like this very, very, very much. It always reminds me of the stuff that David Byrne and Brian Eno used to do kind of around this when they did... My Life in the Bush of Ghosts.
Yes.
Kind of this combination. Maybe this has even, that there was even some inspiration. There is a direct line from Eno working with Bowie in the 70s to what Eno made with Byrne and what Bowie did with Nile Rodgers here. But kind of this whole confusion, this polyrhythm and these kind of Afro jazz.
Yes, that's a really good point, actually.
Though. Yeah, and
this tangential connection to Eno and Byrne and so on. I think it was inspired by Ghanaian kind of high life rhythms. And I've read in your interview, Bowie actually mentions that song, doesn't he? He says it's in the case of something he really likes. I've read other interviews where he is less happy with it. Didn't work out so well.
There's even one interview in which he says he likes the kind of Ricochet as a written song, but what Nile Rodgers did with it on the album doesn't really quite suit him. Just imagine, what could he actually refer to? What's the written song in Ricochet?
It does it does have this bizarre rhythm where it kind of lurches from side to side, and the vocal never quite slides into a pocket anywhere, doesn't it? I mean, with Ricochet, you listen to it, you kind of wait for it to start.
Yeah, exactly.
And it never quite starts.
Yeah, and there's always this strange bit where he goes, Ricochet, it's not the end of the world, and you really don't know what's this supposed to be. Is it a breakdown, or is this kind of the chorus or whatever? But I like this. I like it very much, and it's a bit like a TV theme tune. It somehow gets you in a certain mood. It doesn't really have kind of a strong chorus or a strong melody line that kind of that draws your attention, but it's something it's a bit like, so in a way I know this is a very, very, very strong statement I'm making here, but I would like to listen to Let's Dance with a different track order, with Ricochet being the first song on the record. So I'm really drawing you into this from a bit like Lodger Area, fake ethno sound, and like drawing you into this record on a very lean and very moody basis, and then just showing you what happens next, and then kind of having Ricochet and then China Girl after that. Maybe this draws us to another question. Why an album like this, although it has so many great songs, somehow doesn't really ring for us as a great album in itself?
Well, it's very heavily front-loaded, isn't it? I mean, you start off with boom, boom, boom. You've got Modern Love, you've got China Girl, you've got the title track. Then you've got Without You, and then you've got Ricochet. And then I don't know if you'd even get up and turn the record over after that. But
Ricochet is first on...
Oh, Ricochet is first on side two. See, it's been so long since I've listened to some vinyl. But I like this idea very much. Let's play Fantasy, Let's Dance. Give me your alternate track
list. My alternate track list is... Ricochet, number one, then A China Girl, then Criminal World, because in a way it's kind of similar to China Girl. It has a very similar tempo. So you could get something like it's a bit like a DJ would put on Criminal World right after China Girl to get a good, not to break the mood, but to get something different. And I think this song might actually sound better because China Girl brings you in the mood, and then something else comes up, because to me, Criminal World on this record as it is kind of the weakest song.
But I don't know. I think it's not bad. I think it's definitely better than, say, Shake It.
Yeah.
I think it's better than Cat People. It's actually a cover, isn't it?
It is.
I don't know if this is well known, but by a very obscure outfit called Metro, a British outfit, who
imitating his imitators.
Yeah, I mean, he does this sometimes. He did this on Black Tie White Noise when he did that Morrissey cover, which.
Also
he,
produced by Nile Rodgers.
They were, wow, fantastic, yes. Or, you know, he does, he pays homage to somebody who was clearly inspired by him. But, yeah, so you think that...
Okay, Criminal World, Criminal World. Shake It as a kind of a smooth...
I don't think Shake It even needs to be on the album, Shake It, so...
No, but this is kind of the moment, the weak light moment on kind of last song on
right.
Side one.
Okay.
And then... I would start side two with Let's Dance. You turn over the record and then it goes, and then kind of this very, very strong, you're already in the mood, you had some good and some rather weak moments on side one, and then Let's Dance.
Then you get hit by coming like a train down the
road.
It's the George Martin theory where he'd always say, okay, chaps, let's put a pot boiler on at the beginning of each side. Yes, totally good.
Let's Dance, then Cat People. As kind of the even obviously darker downer after that.
Because you do have a good reserve of goodwill after Let's Dance. I mean, on the album, the cut is 7 minutes long, which I think is too long. And it goes into one of those like very typical 80s breakdowns of like marimbas and bongos in the middle. But you still feel good. So I think you can get away with putting Cat People after that.
And I know this is very, you might not agree, but I put Modern Love exactly then. Modern Love would be track three
in the middle of side two.
Because this is exactly the moment where a really, really strong song, where you kind of, you're muddled down by Cat People. And then just imagine the effect that this song would make, exactly because you would have to save a great moment for this kind of position on the album. I put Modern Love there, especially also because it's a song about hope. It's a song about looking forward. It's a song about, as I said, a song about running, a song about getting into motion, a song that's driven and that drives you. And put it there, and then Without You, kind of also kind of a love song, very direct love song. Without You as the last song for the album. I think that it would just kind of spread the big moments, put them into strategically more... better positions.
I think we should make a Spotify playlist in this order, and then I'll put a link to it on our Facebook page because I think that's a fantastic idea.
Would you have a different?
Bless
I know this is spontaneously that might be difficult.
I would change Modern Love and Without You around. Mm-hmm. I'd put Without You after Cat People. Mm-hmm. I think Without You has. I like it. I don't think many people like this, but I really like Without You. I think it's a lovely, sweet song, and it's got. Little bit of Stevie Ray Vaughan doing his little subtle shows. It's very. I could also imagine Annie Lennox or someone singing this. You know, it's a really sweet song. But then imagine having Modern Love at the end. You know, as this huge, you know, like this big showstopper tune. That's what you end up. What a breathless way to go out.
Yeah. Well, possibly.
Yeah. Well, we'll put up a Spotify playlist of the Joachim Henschel mix.
Maybe people can send in.
Send us your mixes. But you're right. I mean, this is a good point. I mean, I think it's a really bad sequencing. I don't know who is responsible for this. But you don't just front load an album like this and put, you know, literally put like a sort of downward curve. And
they must have known that these were going to be the singles.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Those were the three singles. Was Cat People a single?
Cat People was on the B-side of the Let's Dance 7. The new version of Cat People was on the B-side of the Let's Dance 7-inch, but Cat People as kind of the soundtrack version was a single in early 82, I think.
But it was an album designed to go out on the road. It was an album that was really meant to be punchy, fast, clean, loud, 80s, brash. Mm-hmm. I think it's the beginning also of the end. In the sense that it's the beginning of his massive downward spiral in the 1980s.
Yeah. And we have another quote from the interview.
Oh,
because I also asked in this interview, Bowie didn't give me the opportunity to ask a lot of questions because he was just talking. Sometimes I had to interrupt him because I had my list of questions and I had some points I wanted to discuss and I asked a question and then he just looked at me and laughed and continued exactly on the point when I had interrupted him.
So he wouldn't always respond to you? Do you think that he was just going off on his own tangents?
Yes.
But was he good company, though?
he was, especially in the beginning when we started the interview and did a little bit of chit chat, he was very, very nice and very funny. And I had brought him a present, a CD by a band called Destroyer, mm-hmm. a Canadian band that was almost unknown at the time, one of their early records. And it reminded me of Bowie. So I thought this might make a great present. Of course, he knew them. I had this, especially the end of the interview was very strange and a little embarrassing because I was very, very excited going there. And I thought, what am I going to wear? What do you wear when you meet David Bowie? Just a few months earlier, I had seen Lou Reed in Munich and I had bought a Transformer t-shirt, black. Mm. And I thought, oh, I'm going to wear a Lou Reed t-shirt. Maybe that will somehow spark the conversation. But it didn't, Bowie didn't refer to this at all. And just kind of when the interview was over after 1 hour and we kind of said goodbye and kind of the next interview was already standing in the door, he suddenly said, that Lou Reed t-shirt, did you go and see him live? And I said, yes. And he said, so how did you like it? And I said, well, it was a great show, but one thing I found particularly embarrassing because Lou Reed had brought along his Tai Chi teacher and he came on stage for 2 songs and did some very strange dances and very esoteric Tai Chi inspired dances. So I told Bowie, I like everything, just I didn't like the Tai Chi teacher that he brought on. Bowie looked at me and he said, well, Lou Reed's Tai Chi teacher is actually also my Tai Chi teacher. Yeah. But I think kind of the whole embarrassment in that was actually...
But you didn't say anything bad about the Tai Chi.
I said he was
unnecessary in that context, but you didn't say he was a bad man or he was...
Bowie, actually, he grasped the situation. I think it was kind of a joke designed by him. He knew that he would make a very good punchline now by telling me that this was his kind of... in a way, said something bad about
it. Isn't it something about rock and roll when you Tai Chi see those photos of them in the early 70s together, like these two space glam rock aliens, you know, with the massive drug habit, everything, in their final years sharing a Tai Chi?
Even I think I didn't even ask him, but he also went on about how Let's Dance was, as you just said, the beginning of the end for him. For some years.
Well, should we listen to it?
We should.
Okay.
Well, what happened to me as an artist is that the huge success of that really put me off balance. And I played to the house. Mm. You know, I really played to the gallery after that and produced 2 albums. Mm. I wrote them thinking, well, what would they enjoy then? Mm. You know, I mean, obviously I can't do Scary Monsters for this lot. Mm. You know, they all buy Phil Collins albums. You know, give me a little bit more. We haven't finished. Thank you. We won't be long. And it left me kind of at sea. And I gave into my, I think, my lowest impulse, which was to write for the crowd. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Trying to get second guess what they wanted, which I had never done before, second guess a crowd.
Yeah. Crowd of people who were not especially fans of you.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But, it was nonsense. That was a 4-year, very fallow period, which for me stretched from 84 to 88. Mm-hmm. Those 4 years were very bad for me career.
But nevertheless, in hindsight, maybe you can be lucky that that had happened. Because
I was extremely lucky that I got out of it. That, you know, I was forever grateful to Reeves Cabral for kind of, you know, working with me and for me and helping me achieve back some kind of balance in my writing and all that, you know. And for me, the best thing I ever did was form Tin Machine.
He's forever grateful to Reeves Cabral's
for planting the idea of Tin Machine in his life.
But that's really, really fascinating to hear. I mean, he's said that so many times in interviews, was that, you know, the Phil Collins years writing for this new audience. I'm really surprised that somebody of Bowie's intelligence and wit couldn't have predicted this happening in 1982-83, when he made such a determined play for mainstream acceptance. What did he think was going to happen? Did he think he could go back to the studio with Brian Eno afterwards and Fripp and, you know, whoever, and sort of start churning out more experimental music? I mean, it's a funny one, isn't it?
Especially because I think that he made some of the very strongest singles of his career in the 1980s. Maybe not album material, but stuff like Absolute Beginners, the Absolute Beginners song. This Is Not America, which was another big hit in Germany, as by the way, it was his second biggest hit in Germany, really? Went to number 5. So, wow. Yeah. And even Underground, the song he made for the Labyrinth movie, so I wouldn't see it as black and white as he saw it anyway. Yeah, and yeah. On the other hand, when you look at stuff from the Glass Spider tour, from the Serious Moonlight tour, you don't really have the impression that he's not enjoying himself, do you?
No. I was reading an article in which the photographer, Dennis O'Regan, who was the tour photographer, was talking about his time on that tour. And he was saying he was happy. He was a very happy person, personally, professionally, at that time. And that's something that Carlos Alomar has also said on the tour. Obviously, Alomar was back on the tour. And he said he was relaxed, he was happy, he was delighted with the reception he was getting. He was obviously delighted to be earning money. He was thrilled at the reception that the tour was getting around the world. Yeah, he seemed in a very good place. And you could forgive a blip which came after this in the form of Tonight, which was rushed, just wrong on every level.
Yeah, but had Loving the Alien, which is also it's a fascinating, it's a beautiful song about
beautiful
religion
song.
And alienation and all that. And I think it's just, I know that maybe one song doesn't outweigh the rest of rest of the album.
You're right.
But on the other hand, I think you could still, just when enumerating the great songs that Bowie did in the 80s, I think you could still get a big, big pile off. And I think, on the other hand, not everything that he did in the 70s was great stuff.
Absolutely true.
On the other hand.
And we're going to be seeing this great, great pile, because I think next month they are reissuing, well, it comes to the latest in the Bowie box set series with, what's it called?
It's called Loving the Alien.
It's called Loving the Alien, isn't it? Yeah. And I think what we have there, it's interesting, they actually created something which is very Vogue-ish in the early 1980s, the Dance Remix album. Mm-hmm. So it's just called Dance. So that's finally going to be included, which is just, I think, fairly pointless, long remixes of Let's Dance tunes. Here you have the full excess of 80s extended mixes, dub mixes. Bob Clearmountain, no doubt, is involved somewhere, as he normally is. And then, we descend into the mire of Tonight and Never Let Me Down. But you make a very good point, which is, the singles were by and large pretty good. You know, Absolute Beginners, one of his best songs ever. Mm-hmm. Blue Jean, I thought, was
Blue
amazing.
Blue Jean, yeah, exactly.
What a fantastic song.
Yeah, absolutely.
Loving the Alien. Mm-hmm. You know, these are all brilliant. Even Dancing in the Street is just like a huge, massive laugh. You know, it's two drunk old queens having a fantastic time, having a lot of fun.
I think the young ones doing Living Doll with Cliff Richard is a bigger laugh. From that time.
It is. I mean,
the most obvious thing, and it's even, it's ridiculous even mentioning it, is that in the 1980s, Bowie stopped being an influence on others, but rather sounded like being influenced by others himself.
Absolutely.
As even something like Tin Machine, even though he thinks by himself that this was kind of a pioneering thing and he invented grunge, or whatever, he really said that later in the interview, even though he thinks he pioneered that also all this stuff, the typical 80s gated reverb rock and roll sound came from other people. And so in a way, he was not driving things. He was driven by others.
I think
I think this is the main story of Bowie in the 80s. And this is in a way even true for Let's Dance, because as I said before, he kind of brought in a trademark sound by another producer. Mm. And he profited from that, but it was not the kind of artistic statement that he used to do before.
Instead of setting the trends, he was now following them.
Yeah.
And I think that's a wonderful note that we wrap up this edition of Album to Album on. But Joachim, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having
me. Lovely conversation. I've really, really enjoyed it.
Thanks. Me too.
Okay.
And that was Joachim Henschel talking to me about Let's Dance. And I really hope you enjoyed that conversation. I really, really did. That's about it for this edition of Album to Album. As ever, if you've enjoyed this edition, please do share, like, review, rate, all the different things that one can do. I will be back with you next week with another installment in Album to Album. Thank you for listening and goodbye.